made this.
What would you say if I told you things had never changed and we'll find a way to take our dreams and rearrange them? Who'd believe that we could be in love again? So let's just pretend that you and me can be just good friends.
Welcome back to You Have Been Watching, a podcast devoted to looking in depth into the fascinating curiosity that is the British television sitcom, part of the We Made This podcast network. I'm not Paul Nicholas, I'm actually your host, Tony Black, and I'm joined by my co-host.
What?
I know!
I thought I was talking to Paul Nicholas.
Well, I'm sorry, Pen, it's not me. But my
I am Jan Francis, though, but...
You got the better end of the deal here, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Instead, it's not Paul Nicholas or Jan Francis, it's Robert Turnbull. And in this episode, we're looking at John Sullivan's romantic comedy from the 1980s, Just Good Friends. While on a terrible first date, middle-class Penny Warrender, played by Jan Francis, bumps into Vince Pinner, Paul Nicholas, a Cockney wide boy who jilted her at the altar 5 years earlier. Despite Penny's snobby mother, Daphne, played by Sylvia Kay, despising Vince, who she calls Thing, Penny begins to accept Vince's advances again as they figure out whether they remain in love or they can truly be just good friends. So,
no, I was waiting for the theme tune to come.
Well, the theme tune will have been in the credits, Rob, but, you know, I could sing it. Maybe I will at the end for a bit of fun.
It's the pretend.
Yeah, okay. Firstly, right, before we get into this, welcome back. It's 2023. Welcome back, everyone, to the show. Welcome back, Rob. It's nice to do this again with you. And you've had some lovely news in the interim, haven't you? Because you've just had a lovely new baby. So congrats.
No, thank you very much. I think even more exciting than the baby is that I've managed to create a private recording space to do this podcast.
So when your child listens back to this,
there.
Well, you have, I have. But when your child listens back to this when they're older and realises you were more happy about your podcast shed than their birth, I think that's going to be a lovely, tender moment for them, don't you?
I'm not worried. My kids won't listen to this shit, don't worry.
What, they're not going to want an hour on Just Good Friends? Like, who isn't going to want that, you know?
Well, I'll have already given the PowerPoint to them by then, so they won't need it. But no, thank you. Yes, we've welcomed a second kid into our home, which is absolutely lovely. Very exciting. Yeah. And
fab news.
Yeah.
Fab news. That's wonderful. So yeah, before we begin talking about Just Good Friends, quick reminder, guys, please follow us on Twitter at YHBWatchingPod on Twitter, where we'll post links to the episodes and retweet anything here and there. And please do drop us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or your other podcast provider that you're on, because it really does help us boost up in the ratings. We've had some good downloads lately. We've got people listening. You know, thank you to anyone who has returned for a new year. And like we said, at Christmas time, we're going to try and be a bit more regular this year. So we really appreciate you. Thanks, guys. But if you could drop us a little review, that'd be wicked. That'd really help us. So yeah, let's get on with it, shall we? And dig in. We thought we'd start with this one because we're going to potentially do like a comedy films episode, but that's been slightly delayed. That is coming soon. But we thought we'd pick like Valentine's Day around this point of romance to talk about a romantic show. And Just Good Friends, Rob, was, I think, the first one that leapt into my mind. It was either going to be this for me or As Time Goes By, which is one would be interesting to talk about. But this one's a big one, really, for the romantic sitcom genre, isn't it?
I was going to say, for the romantic sitcom genre, this one is, there's a real heavy level of rom-com about this, yeah. I think, which makes it a really good one to kick off with. Because a lot of the other romantic sitcoms, they tend to be more sitcom-y, whereas this is more rom-com-y, if you like.
Yeah. And in some ways, rom-dramedy, really.
Well, yeah, so I didn't want to jump ahead of myself, but yeah, I mean, this is almost not a sitcom, I think.
It skirts the edge in some ways. So let's start with our history with it then. So when did you first see Just Good Friends, Rob? And overall, what do you think about it?
Well, I always feel bad because whenever it comes to this first question of like, when did you first see it? I always come back with the same really vague answer.
I don't know.
I can't really quite remember because I'm really old. In my mind, I feel like I watched this at broadcast. I can't have done because I would have been just a little bit too young. Just a little bit too young. So I guess I must have been watching it on sort of like maybe first or second repeats. You know, first series was 83, sort of last series was 86. So maybe I was watching it around 86, 87 when it was still a fresh repeat as opposed to an old repeat. Unlike you, I think it's sort of like across the board, unlike you, we didn't have UK Gold growing up.
Right, yeah.
We didn't have any. So for me, none of these were ever, you know, kind of like the UK Gold platform. It was always sort of like channel repeat, so BBC repeat. So yeah, when I was little, sort of close to broadcast, so you know, in the early to mid 80s, when it was still quite a fresh product, I was watching it then.
I remember it being on when I was very little. So I was born in 82, as I've probably said before. And my mum liked this show. And I get why, because like it's a very sort of mum kind of show, this. And I don't know if my dad was that bothered, but I remember my mum really liking it. And
sounds like the parents in the show.
Well, a little bit. I think my parents were somewhere halfway between the Warrenders and the Pinners, I think, really, in some ways. Yeah. I remember that being on. It was weird. I didn't watch it as such because I was about, you know, anywhere between 1 and 4 years old. But a bit like how Evita St. Pet scorched in my memory at a young age, this also did. Being on TV, I can remember very little seeing Paul Nicholas, Jam Francis, and I remember it being the first time I've done a proper full watch is in preparation for this podcast. But I've caught bits and bobs over the years on things like UK Gold, etc., where these things have been repeated. And it's a funny one, this, really, because I can totally understand why it was so successful and so popular. And it was. I mean, at the point the final episode aired, with it did 3 seasons. It did a feature-length Christmas special between seasons 2 and 3. And the final episode got something like 21 million viewers for the finale. Christmas Day, or Boxing Day, I think, 1986. Totally understand why it was so popular. But it's not really very funny. And it's very charming. It's very charming. It definitely makes you smile, but it's not in any way a laugh out loud kind of show. And that's not necessarily a criticism, I would say. You know, not all comedy has to be gags, 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 hit rate, hit rate, hit rate. But it definitely doesn't have the balance of comedy, you know, dramedy and pathos on the one hand, which it does have, and the level of gags and funny moments and funny characters that only Fools and Horses has. Because we're talking about John Sullivan, so these two shows there is a timeline crossover period between when they're on, and if you line the two up, there is a big difference, I think, between those two shows in terms of the gags. And I think that's why Only Fools has had, I think, the shelf life for 40 years that I don't think Just Good Friends has, actually.
No, well, I mean, I think, and like, it's a fascinating one, and I don't want to go off too much on John Sullivan, because I feel like we can almost have an episode about, we should have an episode about John Sullivan one day. But it's interesting, because I think that one of the things that prevents it having a shelf, like, you're completely right, it's like, it doesn't have the gag rate. You know, you can watch early episodes of Only Fools and Horses, you can watch Citizen Smith, And it's just like bang, 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 gag, 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 all wrapped up in really good writing, good performances, and good characterization. That I think it would be hard to argue that John Sullivan isn't a really good writer with good characterization.
Yeah.
And when he's focused on it, it's just like gag, 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 gag. This, I think, has less of a rewatch value for two reasons. One of them being that it has less gags. And we'll dig into this in a moment, but I think that's deliberate. I don't think it's...
Yeah.
This is not about the gag rate. I think that's a very... I think it's clear that it's not about gag, gag, gag. But the other thing is that this is actually a self-contained story. So you kind of have to watch the episodes in order. And once you get to the end, it's finished. It's wrapped up. And sometimes I think that is not... It's not as rewatchable. You know, only Fools and Horses, you can go back and you can watch a Grandad episode, then an Albert episode, then you can watch Cassandra episode, and then you can go and watch another Grandad episode. Don't watch the Cassandra episodes. God, anything.
Yes, but...
Nothing focuses on Cassandra.
But do you not think that Rodney and Cassandra is basically this in Only Fools and Horses world?
Completely in Only Fools and Horses world. I think... absolutely. It completely is that sort of like that transfer of character. I mean, I think if you look at when Cassandra joins Only Fools and Horses, and also when Just Good Friends finishes, there's definitely a kind of a porting of that narrative because it was so 100%. Popular. Well, this is the other thing. I mean, without jumping ahead of ourselves, Just Good Friends was only meant to be two series and the feature length special, and it was only because it was so popular that he brought it back, and it was a couple of years later. It's like it took a couple of years. But I always felt, watching John Sullivan's writing, particularly when you get into like the later episodes of Only Fools and Horses, and 100% when you look at this, that he was a comedy drama writer, almost trapped in the world of sitcom. And he did a couple of things like Roger Roger along the way, which were more kind of like comedy drama.
That
but this...
It was a great show.
Roger, sort of,
Not many people know about it now, but that was really good.
Yeah, it was really good. And of course, later on, you know, the last few things he did, the Rock and Chips, which that wasn't sitcom, it was comedy drama. And I know, I keep saying it, I know we're going to like jump in and dig into this in finer detail in a moment, but I think that the writing on this sitcom is actually some of the best writing that John Sullivan has done, like genuinely. And I know that we can look at Only Fools and Horses and we can talk about the gag rate there, and we can look at, you know, Roger Roger, Rock and Chips, but I genuinely think that the writing in this sitcom is some of his best writing, especially if you strip it away and think of it not as a sitcom but as a comedy drama.
Yeah.
But I also want to say, like, when I was talking about, you know, watching it as a kid, when I was a kid, I think the reason that I liked this so much is I had a real soft spot for like for romance, like characters falling in love, but especially characters falling in love with sort of slightly sort of real world obstacles to get past. It's like I was obsessed with, well, I used to like the screwball comedies, you know, like Bringing Up Baby and that kind of stuff, but I also loved things like When Harry Met Sally. And for this, when I was a kid, the thing that I really liked was that I really liked them sort of falling in love, but how it wasn't quite working, and how did they make it work? And of course, I was in love with Jan Francis because she was beautiful, and I was just like, you know, adored her. But yeah, I think it's honestly a fascinating piece of writing. Sorry, I'm going to stop talking now. We can move along, then I'll come back to.
No, you're right.
I've got all these points that I want to like splurge out.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
Do them in order. People don't want to hear a monologue.
No, you're right. You're right. It is really good piece of writing. I think you're definitely right about Sullivan being a comedy drama writer in some ways first. And that's why I think he got away with more over the 80s. And, you know, we'll talk about this more when we do Only Fools and Horses, which we will do. You know, we're kind of saving that in some ways, I think. I mean, we did talk about doing that last year, but I think...
It's tricky, isn't it? Because it's so big you want to do justice to it, but it's also so big everyone talks about it. So you're like, well, let's try... I like the fact that we're looking at, like, Just Good Friends first.
Yeah.
But there is always that little thing. You can't talk about the less prominent shows without coming back to Only Fools.
No.
It's kind of like... It's almost like we have to get it out of the way. It's like the, you know, It's like the two people who are very attracted to each other who have to sleep with each other to get it out of the way. A little bit like Vince and
Penny. Little bit like these two. Yeah, it's a good comparison. But no, that's it. It's exactly it, because, you know, with Only Fools and Horses, Sullivan establishes, you know, and he gets away with the longer form, almost dramery kind of episodes on that, you know, that he does with the Christmas special here. And nobody else was getting away with that in the 80s. And few people have frankly. You know, the BBC let him do things that most people weren't able to do. But there's a real distinctive style with Sullivan's writing, which is character-based first and foremost. And a lot of Just Good Friends doesn't have much plot, really, per episode. A lot of it is Vince and Penny having a conversation where, you know, Penny's frustrated at Vince or doesn't trust him. Vince is trying to be charming or there's a bit of a mix-up, or different characters are, you know, there's culture clash comedy, that kind of thing. But it is based on characters first and foremost and character motivations. Only Fools and Horses, by necessity, given the setup, had more plot because they were wheeler, dealer, traders. You had to have a bit more of that. And there were certain episodes that were more, you know, set in the flat or whatever. But Just Good Friends doesn't have to do that. Just Good Friends is because it's about a relationship, and it's about a relationship that ebbs and flows over a couple of seasons. Sullivan focuses first and foremost on these two very different people and how they come together, how they contract, and the jokes are very much built into those conversations in a way that that's why they don't come out as gags. But Sullivan, there is still in this the distinctive gag setup mechanism that is in Only Fools and Horses. And you can see it, you know, you can tell that Sullivan loves doing a little bit of a dramery bit and then finishing with a little bit of a twist joke at the end. He does that all the time. And he does it here. It's not as broad or as acute as in Only Fools here often. Even though I do think that you could absolutely make a case that this and Only Fools and Horses are set in the same universe, without a doubt.
Oh, of course
you absolutely
they are, yes.
could have the Pinners rock up in Peckham, you know, with you easily. Like you could definitely.
Oh, they're distant cousins, aren't they? It's like
absolutely. The Pinners and the Trotters are absolutely distant cousins.
Oh yeah, the Pinners over in of course they
absolutely.
Are. Like, they're all related.
Yeah, and Only Fools and Horses is constantly about class comedy. You know, there are so many instances, and you know, Cassandra's a great example of that, because the core of Just Good Friends is the class barrier that Penny's. Well, it's the flip class barrier, because Penny's and her family are ostensibly posh, but they're not actually that wealthy, whereas the Pinners are rough as muck and they've got loads of money. So there's a little bit of Boise and Marlene in the Pinners as well, actually, and you know, in that same thing, you know, I mean, Reet is very Marlene, you know. It's like, oh, hello, dear, that kind of thing. And so there's a lot of that all mixed in with this. But then with the Rodney and Cassandra thing, it is about, in that case, it's much more of a Rodney's poor, Cassandra's from wealth, and they're much more middle class. So it's not exactly the same, but it is essentially the same conceptual idea. And Sullivan is very interested, I think, in not only the class barrier, but how that interferes with relationships, and particularly a romantic relationship. And he's quite an old-fashioned romantic. I mean, you talked about the screwball comedy kind of stuff, and that is totally what, in a way, that's what this is. It's an extension of that kind of thing, Just Good Friends. It is very much the idea that two people who, from different, you know, parts, different tracks, coming together, never quite getting it right, but then ultimately they still love each other at the end. You know, it really does feel part of that lexicon of comedy. And he's a big sucker for that, Sullivan, in the end. You know, and he does that in so many of his shows.
He does. And I think what you're saying about the kind of like the class element of it, and I think that something that Sullivan does beautifully across his work is he writes really believable kind of working class London. Like his working class, you know, I know there are moments in this, especially I think in the third series in particular, where it all gets a little bit broad. And obviously Only Fools and Horses is quite broad. But when it sort of focuses on character, you know, and it is sort of like characterization and for want of a better phrase, the quiet moments, I think there's something so genuine and relatable about what he's writing. In terms of those kind of like working class, I mean, even going back and watching this, it's like the pretty much the opening scene, the pub that they're in, and when Vince kind of walks in the pub, and I was just kind of like, this feels real. It feels so accurate, and I think it's sort of testament to his writing that he manages to avoid too much of that broad hue. Because if you're trying to appeal to like, you know, maybe an upper middle class audience who think of the work, you know, basically Penny's mum, if you're trying to appeal to her as a viewer, then it's very tempting to write the working class characters as like massively big and broad and like, oh, hello, darling, how you doing, sweetheart? Whereas I think what he does, I think he manages to hold it back and he makes them very real and very believable. The first series, I think, is actually exceptional writing, genuinely. And I think there are moments in that, like when we sort of first meet Vince's dad, it's like, Vince's dad is such a rounded character in those first few scenes where we first meet him. And he does become a bit more broad and a bit more sitcom-y by the third series. Definitely. Well, I mean, not to like jump ahead of anything, but like personally, I think that the first series is superb. I think the second series kind of treads water, goes back over itself a little bit. And the third series, I don't think is that good, because I think it goes full on. It becomes really sitcom-y, and the obstacles in their way, it all feels a bit more contrived. And, you know, suddenly Vince is like basically a self-made millionaire after just a couple of years. And, you know, and Penny's family are now on the skids and all this kind of stuff. It all felt very contrived. I mean, it was funny still, but also if you watch it, especially like watching it, you know, watching 1, 2, 3 series after each other, you notice in that third series of it, there's a lot more laughter because it's going gag, 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 gag a lot more. Whereas the first series, I think there's less laughter because it's going for gags less often.
But really, if you think about it, Only Fools has a very similar trajectory, actually. Because if you look at those first couple of series, it's not quite the same. You know, once it becomes a big success, it does broaden out a little bit more. And I think it's exactly the same trajectory. If you think about when this first series came out, 1983, Only Fools is about 2 years old. It's had about 2 or 3 series. And it's not yet at the point that it's really, really taken off. Really. Uncle Albert's not in there yet. You know, it's cut at the end of Granddad's run. But it's still not massive to the point it will be. And it's the same. And then, so Just Good Friends is coming in. Obviously, Sullivan's done Citizen Smith before this, and he's written, you know, through the 70s and stuff. But again, he's not hit blockbuster writer status quite yet in that way. So his writing is more understated at this point. And so that first season of Just Good Friends, it has that feeling about it that the first couple of seasons of Only Fools did, when it's not quite. Well, I think the difference is Only Fools hadn't really found itself at that point. It hadn't really figured out what it was, and it wasn't quite on the mark. Whereas Just Good Friends kind of does know what it is straight away, really. Oh. And so I think in some ways it's more of a put together piece. It's a bit more confident in some ways because it knows the genre it's playing in, and it knows the story it's telling. And as you said earlier, as you alluded to, it's quite serialized. You know, in a way that a lot of these other sitcoms aren't. Only Fools wasn't, you know. Just Good Friends, he's telling a story across and episodes flow into the next, and it's very much about the peaks and troughs that Vince and Penny go through. So as it then becomes more of a sensation and more viewers tick up to it, and then you know, I mean, bear in mind, this got a feature-length Christmas special only like a year and a half or whatever it was after it first debuted. Yeah. And that's a meteoric rise. I mean, it took Only Fools a good 2 or 3 years to get to that.
And what they basically allow him to do in that Christmas special is amazing. It's like, I don't know whether I want to go as far as to say it's unprecedented, but it's pretty incredible what they sort of let him do as a show, as a hour and a half. I'm actually itching to talk about that. Like, having just rewatched it recently, I'm like, I'm really excited to talk about that episode.
It's a prequel movie, that Christmas basically. Special.
Yeah.
You know, it's 90 minutes telling the whole story. Right up to the point that this series begins. I mean, literally, they reshoot the first scene between Vince and Penny on film.
Yeah.
I mean, that I've never seen that before.
That's the other thing. It's like there's no laugh track on it. It's entirely shot on film. It's like proper, you know. It's like, you know, proper location work. And I mean, like, goes to some dark place. I mean, I'm overexcited now.
It's all right.
Before this, we were chatting and saying, yeah, it's just been sort of a short chat. It's a nice little show, isn't it? And now I'm like, oh, what about this?
Yeah.
Don't worry, I'll say bad things about it in a minute, I promise.
That's all right.
But the foot, like, so just briefly on the first series, I don't know how you felt, but because I was sort of waxing lyrical, I think the writing is so good in the first series. And I will come to the bad points in a moment. I'm sure we both will. But there are a couple of episodes of that where I actually feel like I'm watching it. And like, this is a play. This isn't a sitcom. This is a play. And I feel like that whole first series, you could rewrite and condense the whole thing down into a 2-hour stage play that's set in four locations, you know, like the pub, his flat, her parents' living room. Like, you could so easily do that, reframe that. And there are a couple of episodes in that first series which I think are outstanding pieces of scripted comedy drama that you would happily watch on the stage. And the big one is where she goes around to his flat, and they don't spend the night together, but they almost spend the night together. It's a beautiful two-hander, basically. And you're talking about how the comedy is kind of like, a lot of the comedy in this is that you have the dramatic moment and then the punchline, just to sort of skew it, and then back to the... And that's so evident here, because they're sort of so quickly flip-flopping from very intimate, very tender to each other, and then being annoyed and then angry, particularly Penny. There's something very real about it, but there's also something very refreshing about it, the way that it jumps backwards and forwards. And it feels really real, this kind of excitement, but fear that in particular Penny has about reconnecting. But then there's also this, the episode... Wait, is it the next episode? I've lost track now. I've made notes, but I can't be bothered to look at them. But there's the episode where Penny's mother, I think Penny's mother, on the surface, she's like, you know, sitcom mother-in-law.
Hmm.
But I think it's genuinely such a deeply rounded and well-performed character. And the episode where she talks about her Vince when she was younger.
That was a beautiful moment,
It's just this massive, almost a monologue.
But she never admits it's her. She never actually says it's me, but she's essentially saying it's her.
It's a beautiful scene. And again, it's like, it's when you're watching and you're like, I'm not really watching a sitcom. I'm watching a play for today hidden in a sitcom. Mm. And again, John Sullivan's writing and the cast mostly that he has around it. It's just great. And that's why I think that when you then get to this feature length film, it's brilliant.
Mm.
And like, and Graham, this sort of, you know, in that first series, and then to a lesser extent in the second series, but in that first series, we see Graham as, you know, she talks about this person that she married after Vince. So basically a rebound guy, and how he was super reliable and boring and normal, and, you know, has a flymo and is a vegetarian. I won't take the slander as a vegetarian, but she's vegetarian. Okay, she's a cool vegetarian.
Mm.
But this, so you kind of hear about this character, and basically he just sounds boring. And she talks about, you know, Vince was exciting, but he was boring. I couldn't do housewife. Then we meet him in the second series, and he's basically a bit nasty, a bit snidey, and they go to dinner, and he's, you know, and there's sort of some hiccup with their divorce and all this kind of stuff. But even then, he's still basically just, you know, slightly bitter kind of ex-husband. But then when we have this film, this Christmas special that gives you a proper flashback to his, to their relationship, you see that this guy is a cunt. Like, he was, I mean, it's, and I'd forgotten.
But you do see him in series two, though, don't you? He crops up.
He just feels sort of, he feels sort of nasty and snidey. And in the context of series two, it's kind of like, I felt like, you know, it's because it's like, he's the jilted lover at this point. He's trying to be mean because the new boyfriend's there, and he just felt like posher than Penny and all this kind of stuff. And I still felt like he was basically just, you know, sort of like a boring, you know,
He's the anti-Vince, basically.
Exactly, he's the anti-Vince. But I'd, you know, it's so long since I've watched it properly, I'd forgotten how unpleasant their relationship was.
Well, he's abusive. He's emotionally abusive, isn't he?
He's emotionally abusive. It's not, you know, it's not sort of like flagged on screen, but it wouldn't be a stretch to imagine that he's physically. I mean, he is. Yeah. I mean, he does. He sort of he pushes. There's no sort of slaps or hits, but he is physical with her. Mm. I mean, Jan Francis is amazing in that stuff. And the New Year's Eve scene where she just loses it,
yeah,
and like smashes up her house. It's like, and I know it's a little bit kitchen sink drama, but again, you're watching the Christmas special of a frothy rom-com sitcom.
A bit EastEnders.
It is a bit EastEnders.
Before EastEnders was on.
Wow. I love it. I really, really rated what he did with that Christmas special. It's again, real testament to his writing. And that was meant to be the end of it. That was meant to sort of be, you know, I think what's fascinating is that, in the sort of the narrative of that story, is that you have basically two series where they're trying to make it work and they're sort of bouncing backwards and forwards, and it doesn't quite work because Penny is quite emotionally damaged, let's say, at this point, from her relationship with Vince and a relationship with Graham. And Vince, for whatever reason, he can't quite get out of this Peter Pan, you know, he's a compulsive liar, but silly, irrelevant lies, and he, you know, I want to break down his character a little
bit before
we finish up chat. But it's like he's bordering on gaslighting her at times. It's like it's a very weird relationship they have. And so when the second series basically finishes with them saying, "Look, it's just not going to work," that's actually quite a satisfying ending, because it's not quite, well, it almost is a Sam and Diane will they won't they, because it gets to a point with Sam and Diane where you're like, oh, good grief, oh no, just don't. Yeah. You're bad,
but
together
it's the less crowd pleasing ending. It's actually maybe the more emotionally true ending, and the fact it essentially then becomes a loop in that Christmas special ends on the beginning of their love affair, their return, you know, meeting again, and then the end of that is Penny moving to Paris and it not working, and that's a more bittersweet ending, but it's an emotionally truer and braver ending. And actually, it's probably the ending that, if I'm going to argue later that this show is ripe for a remake, and I think that
I was thinking exactly the same,
hugely ripe for a remake in the modern day, and I think you would end the show in that way now. Absolutely, it would be,
of course, you would,
that
yes.
loop, and it would be that, you know, it doesn't work. But back then in the 80s, the era of a blockbuster kind of world, you know, for sitcoms and everything else, it's not the crowd pleaser that everyone wanted. And everyone at that point had become so invested in Vince and Penny, they did want them to be happy and get together, you know? And that's an interesting thing in itself, in that that's why Sullivan writes that final ending, writes that final season, does the happy ending at the end. And it's fine, but in some ways it's a logical ending, but by that point I have to say I was a little bit like, okay, like shrug really. I didn't care in a way as much, because I thought it was
no
quite like fine. It just feels like, yeah, I get it, I understand it, but the ending of that first loop, yeah, much, much stronger as a title.
I think it's a beautiful, succinct and realistic cycle of writing, and you feel like the characters, particularly Penny, you feel like she has grown, like she's, you know, let's be broad about it and say that she's been in two differently motivated but two abusive relationships, or at least oppressive relationships, and by the end of those two series and the Christmas special, she has grown and become stronger and moved on from that. And I found it an incredibly satisfying, like you say, loop. And obviously, it's very interesting as well. You look at production-wise, it's like it was a couple of years. It's like, obviously, the BBC were knocking at John Sullivan's door saying, look, we'll give you a bit more money if you just do one more. Bit more money. Can we just have a wedding? Bit more money. Happy ending. And it shows in that third series that the characters are a bit broader and it's sort of mega happy ending. Everyone's doing really well and kind of rich. And even though it kind of, there's a hiccup because of, I mean, Vince has this like mega Bond villain wife kind of like is trying to destroy everything.
Yeah, that was rubbish. All that stuff was
but
rubbish.
And then they kind of they get one over. It's to be honest, I think it's a really disappointing.
It is the blockbuster season of the show when they've jumped the shark a little bit actually. There, I think
completely
in the Penny's, you know, they even it's got more money, so they actually go to Paris and shoot like Paul Nicholas on the Eiffel, them two on the Eiffel Tower. Like, she's comes back with a really 80s, you know, power woman hairdo,
power,
like, you know, like you said, he's a millionaire now. It's the jump the shark season, actually. Yeah, thinking about it
really
in the most
is.
Part,
it really is.
Those first two are where it's at its best. But like, let's take a quick break, Rob. Right, for now, and then let's queue up a couple of other We Made This Show trailers and see what else is on the network. But when we come back, let's talk a bit more about this, and let's talk about the characters and the actors as well, because like you said, there's some great stuff there. All right, so stay tuned, guys. We're back in just a minute.
Do you like crime stories, books, and people talking about those things? Then you should check out the Red and Buried podcast.
A murder?
Oh!
I'm Frankie.
And I'm Sarah.
And in each episode, we pick a different theme and surprise and delight each other with a cheeky little review.
As you started reading, I was like, this sounds like a romance novel. And then you got to monstrous crime.
Yay, there it is. That's what we're here for, isn't it?
We're also regularly visited by many talented and best-selling authors, including the likes of Chris Whittaker, Elizabeth Haynes, Emma Stonex, Fiona Cummins, and a whole lot more.
I obviously listened to the podcast, and I listened to you interviewing Chris Whittaker, and I thought, oh, hey, that sounds like a really good fun podcast.
If you like your crime books with a big side of silly, this is the podcast for you. Listen to the Red and Buried podcast right now, brought to you by the We Made This Network.
Do you like music? And do you like podcasts? Chances are you like music podcasts. Take this one, for example, Pick a Disc. I'm Matt Latham, and every fortnight a guest comes on to Pick a Disc to talk about an album for any reason that they want to. We'll talk about the album as a whole, we talk about the songs, we talk about any personal stories about the album, any if they've ever seen the band live, and all sorts of other crazy tangents. And if at any point any of that made you want to listen to Pick a Disc, then you can find us on your podcast apps of choice or on the Facebooks and Twitters and Instagram under Pick a Disc. We're also on the We Made This Podcast Network on WeMadeThisNetwork.com and on Twitter at @we_made_this. Goodbye.
Okay, welcome back to You Have Been Watching, guys. We're talking about Just Good Friends, the 80s sitcom from the mid-80s. And the show came about when John Sullivan realized, well, he was sort of brought to task on the fact that he'd not been writing a show with a lead female actor. And he, you know, he'd written Only Fools and Horses about two or three guys, Citizen Smith previously about a guy. He saw a letter in a magazine that was read to him by his wife that was written by a woman who'd been jilted by her fiancé on the day of her wedding. And obviously that's where the story starts, in that Penny was jilted by Vince 5 years ago on the wedding day, which we eventually see in that Christmas special. And we see ultimately that part of the reason is because of her mother, which is something she never quite knows in truth eventually. But her mother's influence, because she doesn't want Penny to marry what she considers under her status. And it comes off the back of the character of Penny, who it's more than Vince, it's her story, this, really. And
completely.
And it comes off the back of the co-star of Citizen Smith, which was an actress called Cheryl Hall. She was the one who complained that he wasn't writing comedy for women, and all his best material was going to male characters. And he said she was completely right. And he wanted to set out with the intent of creating what he describes as a strong and funny female lead character. And that's what he created in Penny. Would you agree, Rob, with that description of Penny? And particularly how Jan Francis plays her. Would you say she's a strong and funny, well-written, independent woman?
I actually would. I'd say that quite... And... Without coming back to the 90-minute Christmas special, which I realise I'm kind of like verbally jizzing all over.
But it's the best episode, let's be honest.
It is the best episode.
There's no getting away from
and
that.
And I think, you know, you have to watch them in order.
You do.
But I think that 90-minute episode actually really bolsters up. So when you first watch the first series, I do think that Penny is a strong, funny woman. But also, in that first series, she's acting like a teenager a lot of the time, and it's kind of like, well, She's, you know, a strong, confident, independent, funny woman, but why is she like a sort of a giggly teenager? It would, you know, is a valid criticism, I suppose. But I think when you go back and you look at the you know, the prequel, it gives you all this context of how unhappy she was and how damaged she'd been by Vince and then Graham, that actually the idea of revisiting that borderline, you know, that sort of first love, it contextualizes that and makes perfect sense why she is giddy.
Yeah.
And why she's almost like rolling over when Vince is being a bit of a douche. And I think it's really well written. I think it's really well performed as well. I think Jan Francis is, you know, excellent in this. Actually, I think that the female cast are the acting highlights in this. I think that both of them are like, you know, really,
I'd also add Anne Lynn as Reet is very good as well in the role she plays.
Oh yes,
because she's much more of a brassy kind of, oh hello darling, that kind of thing.
Bit
she's
broader, yeah.
And it's less new. I mean,
I'm not Vincey, wouldn't do that. No, not
yeah.
Marvin.
So she's kind of in some ways only playing at one register, but she's very good at that. Whereas Sylvia Kay has a lot more dramatic meat to play in many ways, and she has a lot more nuance in that she's ostensibly a horrible snob, but deep down she's not. Like, she's no man like Norman, who is a lovely man, basically, Penny's dad.
A lovely doll.
He's a lovely doll man. But there's no way Norman would stay with Daphne unless she was actually okay. Like, he would have gone long ago if she was. Do you know what I mean? She's a bit Hyacinth Bucket.
Yeah.
But before Hyacinth Bucket was a thing. But
She is. And I think it's like the thing is that it's not, again, on the surface, it's a kind of, you know, it's a classic kind of like sitcom, you know, annoying wife, lovable dad. But it's not. There is a sort of she has a duality. Because she's a dramatic actor, really. He wasn't really like a sitcom-y comedy sort of actor. And I think that there are so many little moments where you do see that everything she's doing is out of love. And she shows these little moments of affection. And what I actually really like in the writing, I noticed it a lot, is her character. Again, it's this John Sullivan thing that in these dramatic moments, she'll make a little joke.
Yeah.
She'll say something which, for the audience, is sort of funny. And Penny will kind of like give her a glance, and she'll follow up with like, no, that's not what I mean. Or, you know what I mean. And it's really nice moments that she gets to say the sort of the snidey comment that gives you a gag, but she does then justify that that's not what she means. She means to be supportive. So I think there's a lot going on there.
Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, you've got supporting characters who have a level of nuance to them and a level of, you know, they're all well-performed, basically. You know, John Ringham as Norman's really, really good. And in fact, the only good thing I think about Series 3 in a way is what he gets, because as much as it's a bit of a cliched story,
so
he gets
more,
much more
he?
To do, because he's out of work and he's looking for a job, and Vince at one point's given him a job, and then he's thwarted by his evil Georgina. Yeah. He's like,
I'll take it all.
Because she's like, oh, I couldn't possibly have him working for me. I mean, she's the thing with her, right, is that no way in a million years would Vince ever marry that woman. Like,
How the hell did that happen?
Ridiculous. I don't buy that for 1 minute, basically.
No. I believe Graham on the rebound.
Absolutely.
Makes perfect sense.
That Penny would be controlled by a man like Graham enough to actually, in her feeling of real sadness, you know, yes. But not Vince. Not Vince and Georgina. Like, no way.
No, he might have married like a real kind of like rough slag.
Yeah.
the anti-Penny.
Yeah, the anti-Penny.
Like, he might have knocked her up and then had a quickie marriage. But he wouldn't have gone for like Uber Penny.
No.
Which is what he basically does.
Exactly. She's
it makes no sense.
She's like Mirror Universe Dark Penny, like Gina.
Yeah.
Like, she really is. So, like,
what, Yinit?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, you've got all that silliness. But Norman's story in that third series, actually, I quite like, you know, in that it gives him a sense of purpose. And John Ringham's always good value. So, you know, they all have good little things to do, really. But it is the centre of gravity is Francis and Nicholas. And Francis had already got a fairly decent career behind her before she did this. You know, I was quite surprised how old they were when they made this show. Like, they were both well into their 30s. Like...
Yeah.
Because they're both around 75 now. I think Paul Nicholas is getting on for 80 now. So, you know, they were cracking on a bit, even though it feels like they're playing a little bit younger, actually, than they are.
But you know what? It's funny. I not to digress on it, but I feel, because I was trying to work out how old they must be. Because at one point, I was watching it as a now man in his early 40s, thinking, oh, for fuck's sake, you're adults. Why are you acting like teenagers? But actually, I think that it's quite I think they're in their mid-20s.
I think that's the idea.
Vince is probably late 20s. It's quite reasonable to imagine that in 1978, Penny might have... But she could have been as young as 20.
Yeah, that's how it seems to me. Yeah, she's really young. Yeah,
20, 21 when they get engaged. So actually, when the show starts, she might only be 26.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that was my instinct. They might say that in the show, actually, in terms of ages. I can't remember...
She has a birthday, but I can't remember if they actually age check her.
No, that's a good point, because I think they might do actually age check. I can't remember, but I think you're right. I think the inference is they're both mid to late 20s, whereas Francis and Nicholas were both mid to late 30s, actually, when they're making the show. And then she's been in things. She played like Mina Van Helsing in the John Badham Dracula movie in like 1979.
I'm so glad you mentioned that
one. You know, I knew you'd know about that, you know, which has an excellent John Williams score, you know, just as a sidebar. And I will come back to composer actually in a bit, because we need to talk about Ronnie Hazelhurst and the theme.
Oh, of course.
And the music in this. But so she's had a fairly distinguished career before she comes to this. And I think you can see that, because it would be very easy to cast these roles with quite young people who aren't massively experienced. Whereas Paul Nicholas had done a lot of stage work. He'd done a lot of musicals. He was in things like Tommy in the 70s, you know.
Yeah.
He'd also had quite a long career by this point. And he'd been on the stage and on screen since the late 60s. And I think you can feel that skill in performance from two actors who have been around the block a bit, who've got experience, and they're able to come to these scripts with a sense of skill, and they can make something out of these characters immediately. And that's maybe a slight difference from Only Fools, in that obviously David Jason has got that in behind him, but Nicholas Lyndhurst is still quite young and green. Leonard Pierce is you know, older, but he's not necessarily got quite that same litany of stuff in his back catalogue. So I think with the performances in Only Fools are a bit rockier to start with, whereas I think here you've got two skilled actors, character actors basically, who really can make these characters work straight away, and I think you can see that experience.
I think so. I mean, I'm gonna swoop in and rip that apart a tiny bit.
Go on then, go on, do it.
I think fundamentally what you're saying is completely true. I think with Jan Francis, I agree 100%, and I think that's probably a big factor that John Sullivan was looking for, because he was genuinely very focused on creating a strong female-led sitcom. I think it's, you know, I think it was very deliberate to pick someone with a little bit more weight behind them, perhaps. Probably the same with the mother character. But I think Jan Francis is excellent, and I love the way the character kind of actually doesn't put up with Vince's bullshit. Yeah. It's like she's sort of like gooey and doe-eyed quite a lot of the time, but then instantly switches and like calls him on it. It's like this sort of like borderline, you know, gaslighting that he does, the never quite being serious, the sort of silly fibs. She doesn't just let it go. She calls him constantly. And I think that Jan Francis makes you believe that she cares about him in spite of all this. It's a really strong performance. I think, though, that Paul Nicholas is the weak link in terms of the acting.
I knew you were going to say that. I knew you were going to say it was him. Yeah, fair enough.
I think you're right in terms of the confidence of the performance, because of his background and everything. And when I was a kid watching this, I loved it, and I found him very charming. He also was the voice, the narrator of the Spot cartoon when
right
I was a kid.
Yeah.
So it's like very familiar. So I think that he's very charming, and there is a confidence behind it, but I think his actual acting is probably the weakest. If we're talking about just acting, you know, as a skill, as a technique, I think it's the weakest in the show.
I can see what you mean. Yeah, to be fair. No, I can.
Yeah, it's like, and watching it back, there are a couple of things about the performance that I can't quite. It's a weird one. I think it's like some of it, you know, you come back to things with a modern sensibility. You know, we've all grown and evolved over the last 40 years. We have different understandings of things. And I've sort of like, you know, touched on before, I think there are elements of Vince's character that you could argue are gaslighting. I don't think that, well, obviously that's not the intention in the show. He's not meant to be deliberately, maliciously trying to manipulate Penny. I think it's meant to be sort of like a flirty kind of wall that he puts up, almost like he's trying to protect himself. And definitely the writing, not just the character of Penny, but the writing calls him out on it. I don't think that John Sullivan is suggesting that the way he behaves is acceptable. Every character tells him that he has to stop doing this kind of bullshit. Yeah. His dad, there's some brilliant scenes with his dad. Even his best mate, like everybody is telling him that he has to stop doing this. So I don't think it's misguided. I don't think it's naive writing. I think but it does sit there slightly when you're watching it. But also there's something really a little bit overly soft about his, I can't quite put my finger on it, but there's something in his performance where it's like, if I was watching this brand new today, this is a brand new show with that exact same performance, I would argue that Vince was meant to have some form of autism almost. There's a strange kind of a slight disconnect that he seems to have with his actions and people's emotional responses to his actions that feels almost like it is somebody who is, you know, is on the spectrum somewhere, which is, and again, that's not an intended.
Yeah.
You know, the writers and the performers had, you know, if any, barely any understanding of that kind of thing at the time.
I admittedly didn't read it like that. I won't lie. I mean, we get where you're coming from, but I think if that distance may come from Nicholas just trying to play it cool, you know, or certainly, you know what I mean?
Yes.
In terms of that idea that he's a bit of a charming white boy, you know, he's... But I get what you mean. I get what you could. It can be read like that, I think, actually, if you look at it from a modern context. But I doubt there was anything in there that they would have been thinking like that. I'd be very surprised, really.
No, not at all. And I think, you know what it is? It's like, I mean, it wasn't like I sort of sat down and kind of went, you know, oh, wow, this character's clearly autistic. It was more a case of there was that slight flavour in the characterization. Yeah. But I think you're right. I think it's like, oh, not a chance in hell. That back in 1983, they were thinking, oh, and the guy should be, you know, maybe he's mildly autistic and he's undiagnosed. Of course they weren't.
Can you imagine?
Doing that. I think you're right. I think it was Paul Nicholas going, oh, yeah, I think I'll be really cool if I'm a bit like this.
But if you remade
but
it now,
that weird thing of what,
you know.
Well, I think that would, it's a bit like we talked about in The Office, you know, on our way back when, the fact that Gareth, you know, you would now... You perceive Gareth now as a modern audience. It's like, oh, I feel like he may perhaps is autistic in some way. And I think it's that same thing. It's like whether or not John Sullivan and Paul Nicholas were writing and performing behavior that they had perceived out in the world, which unbeknownst to them was a form of autism. I think even there,
think
that's
so.
A stretch. Whereas
because,
with Gareth, I think with Gareth, it probably is.
But the difference.
But there's a stretch.
The difference
again,
is though,
like...
we're meant to find Vince lovable, aren't we? Whereas with Gareth, we're not. You know, there's a difference, really, isn't there? So it's, and I think in both cases, you know, there's an unintentional thing there. But it feels like we're definitely meant to be taken in by his long curls and his broad smile and his suits and his charm. You know, that kind of.
Hello,
you know,
Penn.
Pin-up charm. Yeah, hello, Penn. You know, that kind of thing where you get women going, oh, but isn't he dreamy? You know, that kind
of... Nicholas.
Yeah, well, I know. It's hilarious now when you look back, but he was a bit of a sex symbol, you know, back then. You know, he was a bit of a heartthrob.
He's a nice-looking guy.
But his hair is ridiculous.
He is. No, his hair's fantastic. It's a tragedy what's happened to his hair
now.
Well,
yeah, he's lost it all now, hasn't he?
And he has this weird kind of, almost like a David Bowie kind of performance going on. It's like... Oh, you're right there, Penn. Would you like a drink?
Imagine Just Good Friends if they cast Bowie, like, as Vince. Can you imagine?
Oh, Penny, would you like a drink? I didn't want to marry you, Penn. I just wanted to go.
I just, you doing this, I just think of Phil Cornwell in Stella Street doing the impression of Bowie. That's all I can picture.
But nobody does a you know what, his... Oh, sorry, no, I was about to start name-dropping and digressing. I won, that's bad. I'll slap myself in the wrist. Okay. But his Bowie's really good.
It's a great Bowie.
Better than mine.
Yours are my bad.
They're just good friends.
Let's just pretend.
You and me.
Right.
Could be.
We've got to get off this now, because otherwise we're just gonna go into Bowie territory.
It's just impression.
I can't remember what your point was.
Imagine if Christopher Walken had played the part. Oh no.
Penny.
I don't want to get married, Penny.
Ah, Gina, don't worry about Gina. She's just my ex-wife.
She's back then. She's limped.
This is not good sorry, guys. This is not good podcasting, is it? This watching us listen to us do. So, but yeah, you have two very interesting main characters, I think, who are, yeah, well performed, but there's very clear differences. And I think the show obviously struck a chord, you know, at the time. It tapped into something I think people wanted. I think they wanted a love story, a romantic love story on television in sitcom. And I don't think at the time there was anything doing this in this slightly old-fashioned style of way, really. Quite charming, you know, quite not too sharp or edgy kind of way, really. And bear in mind, there were a lot of sitcoms out there where you had a lot of bitter, nasty sort of marriages or tragic relationships. You know, look at like Basil and Sybil Fawlty, you know, or, you know, Alf Garnett and Elsie, you know, where he's going, oh, you silly old moo, and all this kind of stuff. So it's, in this case, it's like, I don't know if there were too many shows that were doing a lot of this kind of romantic stuff. But after this, you definitely get shows that tap into this kind of thing. Like I said, as time goes by, or something like May to December, which comes out late in the 80s, you know, they're inspired, well, I think, by Just Good Friends.
I think it's not unfair to say that this kind of maybe cemented a genre. Mm. Maybe it didn't create a genre, but it kind of cemented it. Because I think before this, you've had shows a bit like Butterflies.
Yeah.
Which are a little bit about, like, almost like, you know, forbidden, unrequited. It's kind of like, you know, unhappy housewives. And it's like, you know, this almost fit like... It definitely feels younger and more modern than something like Butterflies.
And it
almost feels like the precursor. Like, obviously, Graham is horrendous. But it's almost like, you know, like in Butterflies, this is Penny has married the boring man and now has the boring life and, you know, the stable life. But, you know, longs for, you know, the exciting, sexy... There's a helicopter going overhead, so I don't know if they're going to come take me away for being mean about poor Nicholas. But... I think you're right. It's like there haven't been like a proper, basically, a young, vibrant, and quite sexy sort of like romantic comedy. Yeah, it's cozy and safe, but there's a sort of a sexiness to it. And I suspect that there was something, I imagine this was very relatable to actual young people at the time, but also was very comfortable for older audiences. I mean, even when I watched it as a kid, the character of Vince reminded me a lot of one of my uncles, who, you know, came from a similar social background, but sort of like did well for himself, you know, comfortable in very, very sort of young man in the 80s. And I imagine that he, you know, he would watch this and would have seen himself in Vince.
Yeah, because you never see Vince he's not lounging about, he's not in jeans, you know, he's not in t-shirts, he's always in a suit, you know, he
works hard, he looks after himself, like he is a, you know, a sort of a you know, working class lad made good. And again, the sort of the prequel, the throwback Christmas story kind of, it sort of implies that Penny helped push that. You know, he works as an ice cream. He sells ice cream. He runs an ice cream man.
He's an ice cream man.
Kidder. He's an ice cream man seller, van drive person. But it's like, but even then, it's like he has a job. Yeah. He has, you know, even Penny's dad is kind of like, oh, it's well paid, steady work, you know, during the summer. And then, of course, he get, you know, we see him get a job, you know, managing a betting shop. But it's like, but that's, you know, he gets that job because he's perceived as being a good, good lad. You know,
even though with that betting shop, he's on the edge of organised crime, isn't he? Because there's suggestions that there are dodgy people in the background and all that as well, which is...
There are dodgy goings
like
on.
Like Only Fools.
I think, Yeah, this is it. I think he's nowhere near as close to criminal as Delboy is.
No, Delboy is
just a criminal.
Yeah, he is, again,
he is a criminal. We love him, but, you know, he just nicks stuff.
Yeah, he should be in jail,
Yeah, who took that microwave oven? we all know. But I think there's something, again, quite realistic and relatable for the time that he would have been quite easy for Vince to kind of fall in with the wrong crowd, but he's not that kind of person. So he's always on the edge of it. It's almost like his life and his situation, it's difficult for him to not be on the edge of that world.
Yep.
But he manages not to fall into it. And occasionally there's the odd, you know, he sort of leans backwards a little bit, but he never succumbs, as it were.
Mm, yeah, exactly. So, you know, you've got the show positioned in that quite romantic, old-fashioned tradition, I think, really, that gives it... I mean, it is very rooted in the 80s. It is very rooted in the 80s. There's no getting away from that. And that's part of why I don't necessarily think it, as a show, has travelled through the decades in the same way as something that is a bit broader. And Only Fools obviously spans multiple decades anyway. So even though it is still a very 80s centric show, you know, there's no getting away from that. It does try and adapt a little bit more to the times it's in. Whereas Just Good Friends was compacted in a very short time frame, mid 80s, and it very much is rooted in that sensibility. But equally, it still has a quite an old fashioned sensibility. And I think that bleeds in to that balance between the old-fashioned and the new bleeds into a lot of romantic comedies that follow. Things like As Time Goes By, things like May to December, things like Watching, which came out at the start of the 90s, you know?
Yeah.
Which was very much more youthful in some ways, you know? So there's quite a lot of shows then that come after this that feel like they exist in the slipstream of Just Good Friends. But, I mean, As Time Goes By is probably as successful or nearly as successful and certainly much longer running. But
I think As Time Goes By is probably more, let's say, globally successful. That's a huge seller, you know, outside of the UK. Whereas I think Just Good Friends, less so, but was probably bigger here, if that makes sense.
Exactly. So those things that came after it weren't as big in the UK as Just Good Friends was. Just Good Friends would have been one of those water cooler shows that people were talking about in the work. Oh, did you watch it last night? You know, did you see what happened?
Well, they didn't have water coolers in the 80s. It was taps.
It was tap show. Yeah.
Still at the tap with a mug.
The tap of the mug show, yeah.
Water cooler, what's that? It's 1983.
Yeah, right, exactly. So I think it was, you know, very successful in its time and place, but the tendrils of it absolutely continue to exist. It's why I say, again, that I feel like it could be remade, because I think you could definitely recreate this scenario and a lot of these characters now, and you could do a really interesting modern telling of this same idea of a couple. And you could give them the same names, potentially, but it would be a very different show. But I think you could do the same conceptual idea, because the class barriers still exist, you know, even today. The presentation would be different, but that tension between class and money and status and the core emotional idea of a woman who is jilted by a man who struggles to come to trust him again and has to rebuild that with him over time, and is presented essentially with a choice of be a successful woman making her own way and marrying a man. And that's the thing with this show. In that day and age, that's where it's dated. It was much more of a binary choice in a way for Penny. She either either goes off and becomes this fashion designer in Paris, or she marries Vince. Whereas nowadays it would be a very different concept, because she could do both. So the emotional tension between this would be very different. But as a concept, I definitely think you could do it again, and you could make it relevant for the modern day.
I absolutely agree. It's so weird without rewatching it. I was having those same thoughts. And I think it's a really weird one, because I would say in a lot of ways it's not that it hasn't aged well, but I think for a modern audience, in a lot of ways, this wouldn't sit well. And I think probably because of the, you know, the borderline behaviour from Vince, I think that maybe is more difficult for a younger audience to reconcile. So in certain ways, I think that it hasn't stood the test of time. However, because it's not just a sitcom, because it's really a comedy drama, and the drama elements of it and the narrative of it and the characterization of it are so strong, I think it does stand the test of time. And I think it does inspire the concept of remake more openly, because you kind of watch it and you go, okay, so this character of Penny is really interesting and really complex, and the mum and even the dad, they're quite interesting, and Vince, we're given very valid reasons why Vince chickened out. It's like he's not just, you know, a wide boy who got cold feet. That you understand from an emotional, psychological perspective why he got scared and felt that he couldn't do it. So all of that is in place. So it's very easy to look at it and say, well, that's really good. So if we just lifted it out, put it in a modern sitcom where, you know, Vince was a little less pushy and Penny was a little bit, you know, more mature, and perhaps the power imbalance wasn't there, you could see it working. You can see those elements of it working in a contemporary setting, because it's only the slightest tweak that you need to make it more, you know, palatable for a younger audience.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's absolutely right. I think you could definitely make it work. And I think as an idea, it does stand the test of time, I think. And I think the show itself, certainly as we've said, those first couple of seasons, they are worth going back to. It's not a laugh out loud comedy. It's not going to be one of those joke hit rate kind of things. But it's a well-observed character piece with really good performers. And that core is relatable still. Even if the references have dated, even if certain things are very 80s, there is emotional truth to this idea that is well worth still seeking out. And, you know, it is funny at points. I'm not saying it's not funny at all. There are funny moments in it. There are things that make you laugh.
There are some really, really good standout gags in it.
There are, for sure. It's just not as concurrent as some of the comedies. And maybe one of the reasons that it's not necessarily considered one of the greatest comedies ever. Although when they did a poll of the great British sitcoms in 2004, it did come 43rd in the Britain's best sitcom list. So it was in the top 50.
I mean, that's pretty good placing when you consider the competition and the age of the show. That's pretty
good.
Not
bad at all, really. So, you know, it is still well regarded, I think. But yeah, it's been a fun one to discuss. Would you say there is a standout episode? Really, I mean, I suppose we've talked about it, haven't we? The Christmas special, really. But I think it's almost hard to find others, because it is a serialized show, really. So I can't just say to you, go and watch episode 3 of series 2, because you've got to kind of watch them in order.
Yeah, that's it. And I think that the Christmas episode is absolutely the standout episode, but it's also it's a bit of a cheat, because it only works so well having watched the first two series. And also, it's not really an episode. It's a 90-minute prequel movie. And you could almost watch that Christmas episode by itself, completely out of context, because you get a fully rounded story. And even the little ending which is like the opening of the series, even that, in isolation, watching that 90 minutes... That smile from Paul Nicholas at the end, hello Ben. that's actually enough. If you just want to watch that 90-minute narrative, I think you can watch that and you can see the smile at the end, and then you can make your own decisions on what it is that happens next, you know, although we've got that. But there are a couple... Again, I'm too lazy to look at my notes because they're like 3 inches away from me. But I think it's the third episode where Penny goes over to Vince's flat. And then I think it's the fourth episode where the mum talks about her boyfriend before her, you know, before Penny's father. So I think those two episodes for me definitely had absolute standout moments. But yeah, it's not really... Also, you know what? I'm not going to lie. I would happily say to people, watch it, but just don't watch the third series. Just stop. Stop after that Christmas 90 minutes.
I actually don't think you're going to miss a lot really. If you're prepared to...
No.
If you've listened to this and you understand that at the end they end up together, if you're prepared to watch it...
They have a happy ever after.
They do, but it might be more interesting to just watch where they don't, definitely. I'm with
so
you on
so much
that.
More set up.
Yeah.
And let's be honest, I think that's what it is. That's what John Sullivan intended.
Yeah.
He never intended for them to have the happy ever after. That wasn't what he wanted to explore. That wasn't the story that he wanted to tell. It was only, you know, fans, money, and the BBC that gave us that happy ending. So maybe that's it. Maybe he was really phoning in that third series.
Mm. I think maybe
that's
he was.
That's another conversation.
Yeah. So yeah, we've unpicked it quite well, I think. Here, Just Good Friends, Rob. So it's been a lot of fun, really, talking about
this. It has
been
a lot of fun.
Yeah, and watching it.
You know what? It's almost like a sleeper, I think. It's like you're watching it and you're thinking like, oh yeah, it's gentle. It's a footnote in John Sullivan's career. And then as soon as you start talking to someone else who appreciates the medium and has watched it, and it suddenly blossoms out.
Yeah.
And actually, this is a really good product. It's really worth people's attention.
Yeah.
And there's some, you know, even soppy old Paul Nicholas, there's just some lovely performances. I'm still in love with Jan Francis.
Yeah, she's lovely.
She's just beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. She is.
I really love your eyes. I love your eyes. I love your eyes.
Yeah, she's got a lovely voice as well.
Speaking for all of us.
Had I been 10 years older, I think she would have been a proper, like, fancy for me as a kid, as a teenager. I was just a bit too young.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah. Absolutely, I get it. But yeah, it's great. It can be found on, currently, it's on BritBox in the UK. And although, weirdly, they don't have the final episode at all. So you can find that, or the Christmas special, you can find that on Now TV, where they've got all the UK gold stuff. I think it must have something to do with rights and things like this and whatnot. So it's well worth seeking out. But thanks, Rob, for doing this. We're gonna be back soon for another episode. And... thanks, everyone, for joining us. Remember, we're part of the We Made This podcast network. Please subscribe to You Have Been Watching, as we said at the top, and give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you want to help the podcast network out, please consider supporting us on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/WeMadeThis, you can find me personally at AJ Black Writer on Twitter. Rob, where are you hanging out on Twitter? What's your handle?
I'm always there, never leaving. And I am Forducks, which is FORDUCKS. And that's whatever I'm doing. I pimp it out there.
Fab.
Like the media whore I am.
Same for me. But Just Good Friends is not all we're discussing. So we'll give you a taste of what you might have missed on the network at the end. We're going to play you out with a bit of Ronnie Hazelhurst's music for Just Good Friends. But and stick around till the end, because there might be a little bit of a bonus for you. All right, so stick around till the end of the music. But until next time, you've been listening to Tony Black
and Robert Turnbull. I don't know why I did that.
Robert, do you want to do it again, or are you happy with that take?
And no, let people know I'm a dickhead. It's fine.
And we're off to Paris with a power hairdo to forge a new career. We'll see you next time. Let's talk a bit about the post-credit sequence for Just Good Friends, because I have got to correct myself here, because I remember when we did Ab Fab, I was pretty sure I was saying, this is pretty unprecedented. They were doing post-credit sequences, much like Marvel Cinematic Universe, and Tony is full of shit, because actually, Just Good Friends were doing it every episode here, weren't they?
Yes, and I'm, without going back and listening to it now, I'm sure when we had that conversation about Ab Fab, there's probably a bit where I can go, I'm sure that they like completely started it from scratch.
Yeah, there is. No, there is. There is.
Oh, there is.
Yeah, yeah, I'm pretty sure there is. Yeah.
There we go. 1 point
well
to
done,
me.
Rob.
Thank you.
Yeah, you were right.
just because I'm older, I can remember this show. It's you know, pre-Abfab, pre-Frasier.
Yeah.
The end titles, it's brilliant. It's a brilliant little conceit, because for anyone who's not watched it, you have the sort of the ending of the scene, or sorry, the ending of the episode. It usually ends with a little bit of a joke, but not always. Sometimes it ends with a little bit of a down, you know, Penny saying, never call me again,
and slam
the door. And so the music starts and the credits play over a scene, and the scene will be something like Vince walking around his flat, turning the lights off, you know, making the sofa cushions and, you know,
and
getting his pyjamas on and getting into bed.
And it's the orchestral version of the flugelhorny kind of jazzy Ronnie Hazelhurst theme. Yeah, which is really good. You know, it's a really good theme, obviously. Yeah, by the John Williams of sitcom theme tune writers, as we've called him. But yeah, great theme. And then it just plays till the end, but almost, doesn't it?
And then there'll be a little sort of a final moment. Again, usually a gag, but not always. So in that situation, you know, Vince has, you know, turned all the lights off, got into bed, and then he hears a buzzer, gets up, goes to his door, listens to the intercom, and Penny's like, oh yeah, never call me, and don't try and call me at work. He's like, oh, don't worry, Pen, I don't have your phone number at work.
Yeah.
She's like, okay, have you got a pen and paper? Poor Nicholas does his smile.
Yeah.
Ching, ching. And then,
freeze frame.
Directed and produced by...
Yeah.
But it's a brilliant conceit, because although it gives you these little tag-on jokes, it really helps strengthen the narrative, and it also utilizes every minute of screen time. Yeah. And this, you know, we've talked about this, you know, this narrative that it's sort of serialized. It really takes you in from one episode to the other. It's brilliant. It's fantastic. And yeah, fantastic piece of music.
You actually also get sometimes quite an important plot moment at the end of these episodes.
Oh,
don't
yes, you?
You
can't. So, you can't skip.
No,
out
you can't.
On it.
No, you have to watch till the end, because something will happen, or there'll be a landing of a joke or whatever, and it actually just play into the next. So it's not like disposable. It's not like some of the Marvel movie ones where it's just someone eating some dinner or whatever. Like, you can skip. So I wonder why they made this choice, though, because as far as I know, and right, I'm going to shoot myself in the foot here, because there's probably loads of 70 sitcoms, Rob, that were doing this, but I don't remember one before this doing this. So, like, I wonder what the choice was there for this.
Some mothers do have them. They used to do this a bit, didn't they?
Oh, I can't remember that far back.
I can't remember. I'm sure. I mean, I could be misremembered.
Maybe this is just going to be a trend in this podcast, that every time I think it's the first one, we're going to discover
this is the first one. I mean, I could be misremembering. I think you're more or less right. I don't think it was a common occurrence in all sitcoms, and I think this is probably definitely the highest profile, most prominent version of it. I could be completely wrong about some others do have them, but I feel like some sitcoms kind of did this a bit. But yeah, not to the point that it's a convention, especially if it was, we'd remember it better.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, potentially. But it's a great little extra thing anyway.
It actually, again, in the 90-minute Christmas special, it's utilised brilliantly there, because we've got, you know, we're accustomed to it, you know, two series in. And it really, really works very well in that episode, that Christmas special.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it's a great little ending moment to cap it all off. And good way to cap this podcast off, Rob, I think.
Yeah, Tiny, never call me again and don't call me at work.
Big smile. Ding!